essay, Critique of Violence, examines acts of violence undertaken by individuals who confront radical evil. Any act that defies radical evil breaks the law in the name of justice. It affirms the sovereignty and dignity of the individual. It condemns the coercive violence of the state. It entails a willingness to die. Benjamin called these extreme acts of resistance divine violence. Only for the sake of the hopeless ones have we been given hope, Benjamin writes. Bushnell's self-immolation one most social media posts and news organizations have heavily sent is the point. It is meant to be seen. Bushnell extinguished his life in the same way thousands of Palestinians, including children, have been extinguished. We could watch him burn to death. This is what it looks like. This is what happens to Palestinians because of us. The image of Bushnell's self-immolation, like that of the Buddhist monk in Vietnam in 1963, or Mohammed Bouazizi, a fruit seller in Tunisia in 2010, is a potent political message. It jolts the viewer out of somnolence. It forces the viewer to question assumptions. It begs the viewer to act. It is political theater or religious ritual, potent form. Buddhist monk Thich Nhat Hanh said of self-immolation, "To express will by burning oneself, therefore, is not to commit an act of destruction, but of construction. That is, to suffer and to die for the sake of one's people." If Bushnell was willing to die, repeatedly shouted "Free Palestine" as he burned, then something must be terribly, terribly wrong. These individual self-sacrifices become rallying points, opposition. They can ignite, as they did in Tunisia, Libya, Egypt, Yemen, Bahrain, and Syria, revolutionary upheavals. Bouazizi, who was incensed that Lodi's had confiscated his sales and produce, did not intend to start a revolution. But the petty and humiliating injustices he endured under the corrupt Ben Ali regime with an abused public. If he could die, they could take to the streets. These acts are sacrificial births. They presage something new. They are in its most dramatic form of conventions and the reigning systems of power. They are a complete rejection. They are designed to be horrific. They are meant to shock. Burning to death is one of the dreaded ways to die. Self-immolation comes from the Latin stem, immolare, to sprinkle with salted flour when consecrated sacrifice. Self-immolations like Bushnell's link the sacred and the profane through the medium of sacrificial death. But to go to this extreme requires what the theologian Reinhold Niebuhr calls a sublime madness of the soul. He notes that nothing but such madness will do battle with malignant power and spirit wickedness in high places. This madness is dangerous, but it is necessary when confronting radical evil because without it, truth is obscured. Liberalism, Niebuhr warns, lacks the spirit of enthusiasm, not to say fanaticism, which is so necessary to move the world out of its beaten tracks. It is too intellectual and too little emotional to be an efficient force in history. This extreme protest, this sublime madness, has been a potent weapon in the hands of the oppressed throughout history. Some 160 self-immolations in Tibet since 2009 to protest Chinese occupation are perceived as religious rites, acts that declare the independence of the victims from the control of the state. Self-immolation calls us to a different way of being. These sacrificial victims become martyrs. Communities of resistance, even if they are secular, are bound together by the sacrifices of martyrs. Only apostates betray their memory. The martyr, her example of self-sacrifice, weakens and severs the bonds and the coercive power of the state. The martyr represents a total rejection of the status quo. This is why all states seek to discredit the martyr or turn the martyr into a non-person. They know and fear the power of the martyr, even in death. Daniel Ellsberg in 1965 nissed a 22-year-old anti-war activist, Norman Morrison, douse himself with kerosene and light himself on fire. The flames shot 10 feet in air. Outside the office of Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara at the Pentagon to protest the Vietnam War. Ellsberg cited the self-immolation along anti-war protests as one of the factors that led him to release the Pentagon Papers. The radical Catholic priest Daniel Berrigan, after traveling to North Vietnam with a peace delegation during the war, visited the hospital room of Ronald Brazzi. Brazzi was a high school student who had drenched himself with kerosene and immolated himself outside the Cathedral of the Immaculate Conception in downtown Syracuse, New York, to protest the war. He was still living a month later, Berrigan writes. I was able to gain access to him. I smelled the odor of burning flesh. I understood anew what I had seen in North Vietnam. The boy was dying in torment. His body was like a great piece of meat cast upon a grill. He died shortly thereafter. I felt that my senses had been invaded in a new way. I had understood the power of death in the modern world. I knew I must speak and act against death, because this boy's death was being multiplied a thousandfold in the land of burning children. So I went to Catonsville because I had gone on to Hanoi. In Catonsville, Maryland, Berrigan and eight other activists, known as the Catonsville Nine, broke into a draft board on May 17, 1968. They took 378 draft files and burned them with homemade napalm in the parking lot. Berrigan was sentenced 3 years in a federal prison. I was in Prague in 1989 for the Velvet Revolution. I attended the commemoration of the self-immolation of a 20-year-old university student named Jan Pollock. Pollock had stood on the steps outside the National Theater in Wenceslas Square in 1969, poured petrol over himself, and lit himself on fire. He died of his wounds 3 days later. He left behind a note saying that his act was the only way to protest the Soviet invasion of Czechoslovakia, which had taken place 5 months earlier. His funeral procession was broken up by police. When frequent candlelight vigils were held at his grave at the Osani Cemetery, the authorities, determined to stamp out his memory, disinterred his body, cremated it, and handed the ashes to his mother. During the winter of 1989, actors with Pollock's face covered the walls of Prague. His death, 2 decades later, was lionized as the supreme act of resistance against the Soviets and Soviet regime installed after the overthrow of Alexander Dubček. Thousands of people marched to the square of Red Army soldiers and renamed it Jan Pollock Square. He won. One day, the street where Bushnell lit himself on fire will bear his name. He will, like Pollock, be honored for his moral courage. Palestinians, betrayed by most of the world, already look to him as a hero, and because of him, it will be impossible to demonize all of us. Divine violence terrifies a corrupt and discredited ruling class. It exposes their depravity. It illustrates that not everyone is paralyzed by fear. It is a siren call to battle radical evil. That is what Bushnell intended, and his sacrifice speaks to our better selves. Genocide is the crime of crimes. It is not a political issue, a moral issue. Defying genocide and rejecting all complicity with those who commit genocide is a moral imperative. Those of us who are people of faith are called to invert the world's value system. It is not about the practical. It is not about success. It is not even about victory. In fact, we can find victory by way of defeat. It is about standing, no matter the cost, with the oppressed. It is about our faith, our belief that the good draws to it the good, even if all the empirical evidence says otherwise. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. O you who have believed. Be persistently stand firm in justice. Witness for Allah, even if it be against yourselves or parents, rich or poor. Allah is more worthy of both. So follow not personal inclination, lest you not be just. And if you distort your testimony or refuse to give it, then indeed Allah is ever of what you do aware. The days ahead and frightening, but as Immanuel Kant reminded us, if justice perishes, human life on earth has lost its meaning. It is our task to fight, no matter the cost, for justice, to fight, no matter the cost, for the sacred, to fight, no matter the cost, for life, fight, no matter the cost, to free our Palestinian brothers and sisters from the river to the sea. We may fail, but let those who come after us say we tried. We were true to our call as Muslims, as Christians, and as Jews, that we stood with the oppressed, knowing that when you stand with the oppressed, you are treated like the oppressed. Fenceless under the night, our world in stupor lies, yet dotted everywhere. Ironic points of light flash out wherever the just exchange their messages. May I, composed like them of eros and of dust, beleaguered by the same negation and despair, show an affirming flame. I do not know if we can build a better society. I do not know if we can halt this genocide. I do not even know if we will survive as a species. But I know the forces of death have us by the throat, and they have my children by the throat. I do not fight fascists because I will win. I fight fascists because they are fascists. Thank you.
We have a little bit of questions. Does anybody have a question?
The Western politicians use a two-state solution as a cover, while Israel is out of hand. One-state solution with democracy and equal protection for all of citizens is highly unlikely. This is Zionist apartheid regime. In your opinion, what will become of millions of Palestinians? And would we in our lifetime see justice?
My father, who was a Presbyterian minister, was in the civil rights movement. And what he was fighting for is exactly what we should be fighting for in historic Palestine. And that's called one person, one vote. Everybody has human rights. I think, as Ilan Pappe has pointed out, the hatred, the death, the genocidal violence, while it is being unleashed against the Palestinians, will consume Israel itself. Time, I can't tell. I was a reporter for a long time, and often we knew that the tinder was there, but we didn't know what would strike it. The first intifada would be a good example. What caused the conflagration of the first intifada was a road accident. So those are questions I can't answer. None of us know. But what's clear is that there is no hope if we don't resist. So much of this genocide, it's not just about wholesale murder. It's about erasure. The universities, the cultural centers, and targeting the intellectual class, the writers, the poets, the academics. It's about erasure. And, you know, our job is to, the small bit that we can contribute, is to fight against that erasure. I don't know.
As you have rightly pointed out, the U.S. is complicit in genocide. Without the U.S. support, this war would end tomorrow.
Yeah.
And we all are in the awkward position of being American citizens and living here and no one listening to us. But let me ask you another question, which is, why are the Arab Muslim states so silent? They're still engaged in diplomatic ties and economic ties with Israel, whether through the air or not, if they were to simply break their diplomatic ties and impose sanctions on Israel, that would probably have a strong impact. Turkey, for President Erdogan, is so loudly criticizing Netanyahu every day, but I just discovered it is one of the top 10 trading partners, both import and export, including iron and steel, including arms. So what do you make of that? You have spent a lot of time in the Muslim world, in Gaza and in the Arab countries. Do you see any hope there of a reversal? Thank you.
Well, they're corrupt, despotic regimes. I mean, the only people that when all this is, all, the history of this is written, the only country in the Arab world that can be written about with any kind of honor or is Yemen. Because exactly what it feels like. 1,000 Yemenis starved to death under the U.S.-Saudi siege. And they had cholera epidemics. And so they understand fully what's happening in Gaza, and they're resisting. These are dictatorships. I mean, don't get me even started on Egypt with Hala. You know, before the genocide, it cost $350 for a travel exit visa through Hala, which is run, of course, by Sisi's sons. Now it's $5,000 for an adult and $2,500 for a child. And when they feel like it, they'll jack the price up $1,000. So they're actually profiting off of the genocide. No, these regimes are either sustained or were imposed by Western powers and remain so. See, remember Mubarak, we bought Mubarak off for the first Gulf War. I just came from Egypt. I was invited to go to Doha, Al Jazeera, and I did broadcasts on Al Jazeera English and Al Jazeera Arabic. And then I went to Rafah. I tried to go to Rafah through the Egyptian press syndicate, went to organize a protest outside of Rafah because they've locked all the foreign journalists out of Gaza. And of course, the Sisi government blocked us. They stopped us. So yeah, these regimes are completely complicit in this genocide. I mean, Sisi is a creature of the CIA and the Mossad anyway, so.
One quick question. As we go from city council to ask these mayors to stand for ceasefire, the reaction we get from them is, you guys are asking us too much. Why are you putting us in this difficult situation where you're asking us to be divisive? So in the name of unity, they're saying we are not going to ceasefire. The very interesting thing that's happening in these city councils is we have these rabbis that come with their whole congregations. They act like a mob. And they speak as Israelis. They don't identify as Americans. They say, you know, I was in the IDF, I was in Israel, this and that. And they're the ones saying, hey, you have been elected for local issues. Why are you talking about international issues? So it's like, what do you do with these mayors? And then they come back and they demolish us. Like, why are you putting us in these situations? What do we do with these things?
So politics is a game of fear. And it's our job to make them afraid. That's the only way they respond. They're not going to respond to our good intentions. I was Ralph Nader's speechwriter. And Ralph ran because he wanted to pull 5, 10, 15 million voters, probably Democrats, into a third party to create pressure on the Democratic Party. I'm not going to tell anyone in this room how to vote, but I would not vote for Joe Biden if you put a gun to my head. So, you know, they have to pay. They have to pay for this. And I don't want, but I didn't support the genocide. I didn't do this. They did it. And it won't stop if they don't pay. That's the bottom line. And we have the numbers to make them pay. I mean, imagine this. I mean, this is a black and white moral issue. And if these council members won't do the minimum, which is oppose genocide, then run other candidates and don't support them.
My question, or maybe your comments on that we are the 4 million Muslims living in US and almost 1 to 1.3 are only registered. So 3 million Muslims sitting at home, not going and vote, they cast their vote. So what is your recommendation for them to really actively go register and cast the vote? For rather, you know, depending on who they're voting for, Republican or Democrat, the first key thing is that we have a power of 4 million votes. And we need to use that so we can send the candidates in Congress. Based on our population, we should have at least 14, 15 Muslim candidates in Congress and 4 or 5 senators. So please comments on that. Oh,
So I ran, you know, Ralph Nader is fluent Arabic speaker. His family's from Lebanon. He's Lebanese Christian. And he's always been good on Palestine. But we could not get Arab support for Ralph. That would have not happened if it was the reverse. The Zionist lobby is unified in a way that the Arab, and I think because the Arab world is very diverse. To be an Algerian is not to be an Egyptian. They don't have the kind of cultural uniformity because of their different national backgrounds. They also don't have the money. I mean, we live in a system of legalized bribery. Joe Biden has gotten more AIPAC money than any other U.S. senator in history. He is a creature of the credit card companies in Delaware and AIPAC. And you have to remember that they owe their political career to these moneyed interests. Schumer, Pelosi, none of these people would hold political power but for the money of the Israel lobby and Sachs. And if you destroyed that system of legalized bribery, they would lose their privileged position. And that they will never give up. So unless the system changes, we have to build the kind of moneyed institutions that will back candidates that oppose this endless funding and arming of the Zionist state. But I would also say the most important thing, and here I want to really express my admiration for these young kids who get out in the street and block bridges, and that is so important. And Jewish, and let's not forget our allies, Jewish Voices for Peace. That is so key, and that's why the Democrats are running so scared. And what's amazing about these protests is that not are they sustained. We're now 6 months into this, but they don't diminish in numbers. So there's a moment in memoirs, please do not, where there's a huge, I think it's 1971, a gigantic anti-war demonstration, and tens of thousands of anti-war demonstrators have surrounded the White House. And in order to protect the White House, they put empty city buses in a ring all the way around the White House. And Nixon is looking out the window and he says to Kissinger, Henry, they're going to break through the barricades and get us. That is exactly where we want people in power to be.
You were just listening to Chris Hedges on What the Genocide Says About Us. He spoke in Newark, California in early April 2024. Chris Hedges is an award-winning independent journalist who's covered the Middle East for many years. He's the author of many books. His latest is The Greatest Evil is War. This program is produced by Alternative Radio. We're an independent nonprofit in our 38th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Arundhati Roy, Nader, and Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz. And we have a series of programs with Chris Hedges. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our site, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To get copies of today's program, Chris Hedges on What the Genocide Says About Us, and for his latest book, War is the Greatest Evil, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us 1-800-444-1977. Special thanks to the Palestine Center for Public Policy. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thanks for listening.
This is Anuki, your Faculty of Environment representative, here to let you know what the SFSS is. The SFSS is a student union that is student-led, and it represents and advocates for the interests of the 26,000 undergraduate students at SFU. We are a non-for-profit support network and a voice at SFU, which provides services like the UPass and health and dental. We also provide support to make your student life better. You can reach the SFSS on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, or by emailing us. We look forward to hearing from you. Thank you.
This is Bird Note. In spring, millions of small ducks move into shallow wetlands of North America. Tidal flats, sedge meadows, rice fields, sloughs, and backwaters. When these flocks of ducks erupt from a flooded field, they reveal a dark body with a blaze of green on the wing. Their voices sound like crickets or tiny frogs. These are green-winged teal, North America's smallest dabbling duck. Just over a foot long and weighing less than a pound. As a dabbling duck, they feed from the water's surface by sticking their heads underwater without fully submerging. Around 3 million green-winged teal breed across the northern U.S. and Canada. The male has a cinnamon-brown head with a band of green behind the eye. Both males and females have a green bar on the wing that gleams like an emerald when the sun strikes it. Courtship is elaborate. Males show off with calls and displays, and up to 25 males may court a single female at once. The female selects just one of her many suitors. It's a remarkably competitive courtship ritual that plays out every year. For Bird Note, I'm Ariana Remmel.
This is CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby, independent campus community radio from Simon University. We broadcast on the unceded ancestral territory of the Coquitlam, Musqueam, Squamish, and the Tsleil-Waututh. We also stream online at cjsf.ca and listen to podcasts of our programs on our website.
From coast to coast to coast, you're listening to Informa. You're listening. Oh, I love you, Tara. Let me count the waves. You give me shelter. You feed.